here's a fun fact about your book. I got your book in the mail and it motivated me to finish this like really large paper. And then once I finished your paper, I started reading your book on the ferry. And
I literally
finished it that night in the bathtub.
Wow.
And then I just carried it around with me. Maggie wanted to borrow it. I was like, just wait a second. Because I've been opening it back up and looking at stuff in it from time to time just to kind of remind myself. Not just because we were talking, but because I was like, I relate to that. And so I just didn't want to let it go. Felt good.
Yay. Yeah, my publisher said if we got it out to people in, like, not just a digital copy, but a physical, that it's easier for people to throw it in a bag and just pick it up when they can than, you know, having it on a, like a Kindle or something can sometimes not be that easy. So that's cool. I'm excited that you've read it. That was awesome that you read it that quick time. And now we get to really dive in.
I know.
Okay. I've had so many interviews lately that I felt like have gone really well. And most of the comments have been really great, but I had one recently that went out and a couple of the comments, about 20% were, what a stupid girl. Her parents must have not raised her with any morals. I can't believe she was that dumb. Why wouldn't, like, all these things. And I'm like, you're not going to understand in a 40-minute interview, you know, like, and mm-hmm. sometimes you focus on certain things for that demographic, which is what mm-hmm. I tried to do. And I didn't focus on like the brainwashing and neurology of trauma and all the things that mm-hmm. people would get if you actually studied that topic. But the general public doesn't usually study trauma in the brain. So
it's true. And so welcome to the Arise podcast. And today we have Rebecca Bender. Whoop, whoop.
I'm so excited.
You know, I got connected to you. Well, first, let me do a little bit of introduction. So personally, my therapist said, hey, I think you've been trafficked. And Danielle, I found this really awesome website. And it's this woman, Rebecca Bender. She's got her website going. I was like, I'm not looking at a website. There's no way I'm doing that. No one understands. And so I blew it off. And then later, I got really curious and looked at your website and got connected a little bit and followed along a little bit and then was connected to Rescue Freedom. And through that process, got to know a little bit and hear a little bit more about you. And so when you wrote your book, I was so excited to read it.
Wow. I'm so honored. This is so cool.
Yeah. And I read it. It's called In Pursuit of Love. So Rebecca is an author. She's a mother. She's a leader. She's a speaker, a minister. Yes. We need more women ministers. I mean, you're so many things, a survivor, a law enforcement consultant, an expert on so many different issues. And so it's an honor to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. I'm so honored to be here. And I didn't know that about your story, so really honored to be a small sliver in what you're doing, because you're out doing so many things too. I've loved following you online.
Yeah, so I guess I just wanted to hear, like, how do you find time? Like, we just listed off a lot of titles for your life, and one thing that I've noticed that listeners love to hear from women in leadership is, like, yes, you have had trauma in your background, which so many women have had various levels of trauma, and you're leading, and you're studying, and you're writing, and you're doing family, and you're traveling. So what does that continuum look like for you?
Man, it's all a balancing act a little bit. And I would say I fail at it greatly. I don't, like, I think admitting when, like, I actually don't know that I do that well, or I've had to let, I don't know if these are even the answers that people want to hear, but I've had to be okay with things not being perfect in every area. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we eat on paper plates. Yeah. Almost every single night, unless it's a special occasion, because I don't have time for dishes. I don't have the money to hire necessarily a housekeeper, but sometimes I save up and I will, like, hey, can someone come do a deep clean every quarter? Little things that I have found that I don't have a ton of time to do, I try to delegate and outsource like most leaders with anything else. And so I try to do something similar in my home. You know, leaning in on a lot of help to help with the kids, getting rides to and from things. My mom has been such a blessing for us. She helps us so much. And she's having surgery you know, right in like one of our busiest times for the book release. And so I've had to lean on a lot of other people, even just to pull a shift, like, hey, can anyone take my kids to school on Tuesday? Because I'm out of town. And I, you know, it's not easy. I try not to look further ahead than 1 week at a time. Like, I know what's coming for the rest of the year, but you know, believe me, it's not like I'm completely oblivious, but for this week, I'm focusing on these meetings, these record, these interviews, this travel. And that helps me to not get so overwhelmed with anxiety of like, holy crap, I can't do all this. And it's also about pulling my kids in. Like last night, actually, we just sat down with them and I was like, listen, my, the book's coming out. It's just going to be a really busy month for us. Mom's going to be on the road a ton. And I want you to know that we're in this together. Like you're a part of this book launch. We get to change culture. We get to bring awareness to communities. You're a part of this by you being a great support and help that we, we're in this together. It's not just mom's doing her thing and we're on the side. It's we're a family and we're all playing a role in this season of busyness. So I try to do that. I mean, I don't think that I do all of those things well. I'm just doing the best I can. And I think a lot of people compare each other. We all do this, right? And I have a lot of capacity. And I think learning that that's a gift God's given me for the season I'm in has been hard. And it's also, I will be really honest and say it's caused me to be bitter for people that can't hold the same capacity as me. And I've had to work really hard at giving other people grace. I have a really good friend of mine who doesn't ever remember to get back to me. And she's always like, I'm too busy. And I'm thinking, girl, you don't got half the things on your plate that I have. You should be able to get back to me. And I would think that. And our friendship took a hit a couple of years ago when I kept thinking that, like, I'm finishing my master's degree. I have four kids. I have one going off to college. Do you know how much work that is for FAFSA and applications and dormitory reserve, you know, all the things, and finishing school and trying to finish book deadlines and running a nonprofit. Like, you don't have any of those on your plate. And I find the time to text you. And so it would really hurt my feelings. And that's when the Lord really convicted me. And he was like, not everybody has the same capacity. Just be confident in what each person has in just the season they're in, right? Like, don't compare our summers to someone else's winter and vice versa. And that helped me a lot to be a little bit more gracious and compassionate. And I'm just being honest. I hope no one's like, dang, she's mean. I was being real because I think we all have tendencies to be like that and we just don't talk about it.
No, it's true. Like, I have friends that say, like, I don't know how you do it. And finally, I looked at one friend and I said, you're not going to get it. You're not going to get it. Like, we're going to have this conversation over and over and over. And actually, even the that question had started to stick with me as, like, when someone would say that, even, like, as a compliment, I would start to feel like, oh, I'm angry with you. Why are you asking me this? Like, so just, I get it. Like, you have to live in the tension. Like, accept, it's almost a period as, well, not, it's almost an accepting of your own gifting. And continuing to bless that and then bless someone else's gifting too and not try to rush them and take them into yourself as like they have to be like you.
Right, exactly. We're all not going to be called to the same thing. And so it's learning to embrace one another's giftings, including yourself. And sometimes it's hard. You're like, oh yeah, thanks. I'm good at that. But, and you know, if you ask my husband, I'm not that, I don't have a, I do a lot, but, I probably should do less, right? And so there's a weakness. It's like your strengths can also be your weaknesses. I love being involved so much that I tend to say yes to too many things. And then I get spread thin and my family suffers. And so I've had to get really, I just had to get better at saying no. And it's hard. It's so hard. And one thing I heard a minister say once is, I really want to serve you, but I have to serve my family today. And I've said that to a couple of people and most people are understanding, but I've had a couple of people that have been offended by that and have said, why wouldn't you want to help people? I'm like, do you, like, you know how much I help people. to the fault of losing my own children, you know, like you run that risk if you're not there for your own kids and they feel second to your calling. And I think a lot of ministers struggle with that. So I don't know that I'm nailing it either. I think we're all just trying to do our best as things grow and expand, and it's hard, but we're trying and we're going to fail. We're going to get up and keep trying. And that's,
Yeah.
That's all you can do.
I was just like fascinated. Like, how did you come to the process to decide to get your master's degree? And then it seems like after that, were you in process of writing the book that whole time? Or how did those two work together?
Yeah, I wrote the book a long time ago. I've actually been trying to get a book deal since 2008. I was sending stuff around when I lived in London in the book. And, and no one would sign me in London. And they said, this type of stuff's better in the U.S. You know, London isn't a market, UK isn't a market. And so I kind of shelved that dream. And, you know, as you read in the book, I came back and started over with my life and started writing the book back then. And I actually asked the girl Brandy in the book, her real name's Rebecca Charleston. We chose to use a pseudonym, even though she had given permission because our names are the same. And so it becomes really confusing for readers of which Rebecca are we talking about, especially for Audible, because you can't see the difference in spelling. And so I thank her in the back and acknowledge her in the back of the book. But I asked her to co-author it with me and she wasn't ready at the time. Mm. So, you know, it's like, I've been trying to do it for a while and no one wanted it. Yeah. Everyone said like saturated market, memoirs are really hard to sell, write it as a self-help book, had all this different feedback, but I just kept pursuing the dream that I knew God had for me. And yet you continue on with life because you don't know when it's going to happen, you know? And so all of us, I think, have dreams that you work on little by little and you kind of take off the shelf and you polish up a little and you, you know, it's like side jobs in your house. It's like a constant state of maintenance. Right. And so I started my master's just thinking, you know, I love the word of God is, I just love it. I love culturally contextualizing scripture. I love to see how it relates to us today. I think that there's so many miscontextualizations about the word. I think a lot of people cherry pick scripture and you're like, you know, that doesn't mean that. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I just love finding truth and the word is what's radically, radically changed my life. And so I wanted to pursue that. And in the midst of the middle of getting my degree, I got an agent, a literary agent that signed me and we had to start the book proposal process and got the book deal in the middle of the getting the degree. So it's a lot. You're like, really, Jesus? Really?
Yeah.
But just trusting his timing. And I did take a year off from seminary during this. I had to put it on hold for 1 year. I took a 1 year leave, which they allowed. Mm. And if it would have been more than a year, I would have had to reapply. But I also, it took me like 4.5, maybe even 5 years to finish a 3-year degree. Because I could only take one class a semester. That's all I could fit on my plate. And even that was a stretch sometimes. And I turn in papers that were not edited, but I got them in, you know, and I remember having one professor, he was fabulous. He sent it back and he gave me like a B-. And in his email, he said, Rebecca, your content's great. I can see you put a lot of thought. There's a lot of typos and a lot of grammatical errors. And he said, but I know that you're out like training FBI today and working on an undercover operation and you've got a book deadline. And so I'm giving you this B- because I'm proud of you for staying, like finishing the race.
I love that.
And good for you for turning it in, even though it's not your best work. And I was so grateful that people could see that. Like, I'm trying really hard to even stay in the game, man. Like, give me a little slack.
Yeah.
And being okay with myself for that. You know, like we all want to turn in our best work. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's okay that you didn't turn it in your best work, but you got it done. Mm-hmm. And all we can do is give ourselves grace to just finish the race.
Yeah.
You know?
And as if that one paper is a summary of your best work. And in essence, the professor's like looking at you and saying, actually, your best work is your life's work. And by giving you this grade, I'm supporting your best work. That's how I see
it. So good. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah, it's like a journey. I think when I hear the process of how the book came to be, I was really curious about that. I wrote to you and I said, it's really stunning art. I just felt like connected to it. Our stories aren't the same, but I felt a sense of something that was in the dirt of the book, that it had power. It had a sense of, it had an earthy sense to it. Almost a sense of like, you could tell it was grown and it came out of like groans, like that, like I had to write this. It means something to me, and it's going to mean something to you.
Thank you.
Those are some of the things.
That's so kind.
Yeah.
It was really interesting to write. You know, I wrote it years and years ago, and I probably was, you know, almost too soon. Mm-hmm. I feel like I went public with my story before I was ready. Mm. And there's some things that I had written about in the past, and some interviews and some stories that I'd shared at fundraisers that I'm embarrassed of today.
Okay.
But I wish I would have had more time to process my trauma better. I wouldn't share it that way that, you know, mm-hmm. you pull up an interview I did 6 or 7 years ago. It's very different than how I share my story today. Things that I share that I wish I would have kept close to my heart. I remember things differently now after getting trauma therapy, like, yeah. Oh, that wasn't totally what I thought that was. And yeah. Oh, that happened at a different time than I thought it yeah. did. And that's been really hard because, you know, I'm writing the book throughout. And then a couple years ago, I visited Vegas for the first time since escaping. And I went back to my friend's room and I just bullet pointed just even one, two, three, couple words of memories that were just flooding my mind that I'd forgotten mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. that I really wanted to get in the book. And so then trying to figure out where to put them mm-hmm. in the story. And so, when we got to our first editor, it really felt like she was unpacking just boxes of messiness that I had mm-hmm. written mm-hmm. and helping me find where to put them. And mm-hmm. I was so grateful that she was willing to kind of jump in at the risk of not being able to unread mm-hmm. some stories that might be too much for mm-hmm. people. And she read them and she had to sort them out with me and she would say, I don't know that you want to say it like this. Mm-hmm. I was really grateful for that. And then it went to another editor who is a novelist. And so she helped me. She, you know, would ask me questions like, can you remember if there was any sounds in the background that day, or can you remember what the carpet felt like, or can you remember? And that was really helpful for me to sit and kind of take a breath and close my eyes and put myself back in that night and try to just, you know, vomit any emotion or memory that came out, and mm-hmm. for her to use that to help people feel really in the room. So we just had a lot of great help that helped me through it. So it was cathartic, but it was really messy in the beginning, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm grateful, very grateful for people to sit through the mess with me.
I think that I was confused before going to therapy. And then I think reading your story makes a lot of sense to me, and hearing the process makes a lot of sense. Like, it's really confusing on the outside. If you haven't lived like truly in your body, a lot of us in our culture, we disassociate from our body. We disassociate from memories. Like you say, we have a memory, but do we see the memory in color? Can we taste it? Can we touch it? So it's not like you're alone mm-hmm. in that. And then you add trauma in, and the first thing that goes offline is your speech, like your mm-hmm. the area of the brain that controls speech. So automatically you've lost storytelling ability of the traumatic event. So then when you try to recall it and think about, I just think about you or me or people who are required to testify or tell their story in any sense, the fact that we would actually say, okay, now actually try to tell the memory that goes against the way your brain has stored it. That's really what we're saying, because mm-hmm. your brain mm-hmm. stores it in pieces. And then we're asking the traumatized individual, now just put all that together. Your brain split it apart, put it all together for us so we can understand. Yeah. Well, that's not how it comes out.
No. And you know what? So I went through a couple trainings called FETI. And if anyone doesn't know what they are, look it up. It's so incredible. It's called, FETI stands for Forensic Environmental Trauma Interviewing. And it's the new research and the new science in the brain that's helping law enforcement and this judicial process learn how to interview people who've been through trauma. And it's been fascinating. And it's something that I've learned through it is traumatic moments are memories can be like post-its without sticky on it. And yes. they're just stacked, 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 stacked in your brain. And then a traumatic moment happens and it's like a fan comes in and blows those little papers all over the room. And you have to try to pick them back up mm-hmm. and put them in order. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to probably get it all right. And mm-hmm. so that's actually a sign of trauma. It's not a sign that someone is lying or that they mm-hmm. don't know. And I loved that. It's like it gets it out of order. Someone else described it like saying, you know, your normal day. It's like your alarm clock goes off, you get up, you get in the shower, you eat breakfast, you brush your teeth, right? Real mm-hmm. similar mm-hmm. normal order. Mm-hmm. But if something traumatic happens, it can be, I got in the shower, my alarm clock went off, I brushed my teeth, got out of bed, ate breakfast. And they're like, wait, that's not the normal order. And it's a sign of trauma, is that you don't remember things always in the right order. But it's hard, because when you're writing a book, you want it to be accurate. And so I took a lot of time to like dig through my, my medical records, my arrest records. I had Becca Charleston mm-hmm. look through the timeline. We compared it to arrest warrants, and there were things I definitely had gotten out of order and mm-hmm. I didn't remember right. And what sucks is when you have that realization and you think, crap, I've been telling my story publicly out of order for 7 freaking years. Now what do I do? I'm like, all I can do is admit it. Like, yep, I told it out of order. My bad. It doesn't make the two incidents not happen. It just made one happen before the other. And I didn't remember. So it's all I've been able to do is just be vulnerable about that and be like, yeah, I totally got it out of order for 6 years. My bad. What can you say?
Yeah. I think that's one thing I was wondering too, just, and I don't know if you're free to speak about it, but how does it feel to have your story in this format in the world? Is it more vulnerable? Does it feel, are you feel more contained, or how do you feel? Where are you at with that?
I find myself mixed. It's like, sometimes I'm really grateful to be able to finally have from A to Z it out there, because for so long it's like you're sharing from the stage publicly, but you only have 20 minutes. And so you're like focusing on one thing that you think this demographic in the audience needs to know, or mm-hmm. you know, it's like if I'm speaking at a high school, I'm going to focus on the grooming. If I'm speaking to a law enforcement group, I'm going to focus on some arrest. You don't have time mm-hmm. to cover all of it. Mm-hmm. And that would be hard, because people would, you know, if they would hear me somewhere else, they'd be like, oh, you didn't share that last time. Like, yeah, I only had 40 minutes. Like, yeah. Of course, I wasn't able to share that last time. So it felt great to finally kind of have it all out. And at the same time, I was contracted for 55,000 to 60,000 words, and I had turned in 93,000.
Whoa.
And they were like, you're going to have to cut half of your book out.
Okay.
And that was really hard to figure out, what do I cut? What do I keep? I'm a teacher, so mm-hmm. I had a lot of sidebar. Let's talk about neurology and trauma. And the editor would go, Rebecca, you're using teacher voice again. You just have to tell the story and trust that your readers are smart. And I'm like, but what if they're not? Mm-hmm. And what if they don't get brainwashing? And what if they don't understand? I really want to teach them. And even now, like I did the Audible book, and I thought, I walked away kind of crying. And I remember calling my friend Becca in the book, and I was crying. I was like, man, I feel like I barely touched on 15 mm. things, and I wish I would have done a deep dive on 5 instead. Mm. And there's nothing I can do now. Like, crap, it's out there. Like, what do? You know? And she's like, you can talk about those 5 things in podcasts. You can talk about them in blogs. You can do interviews and really do deep dives mm-hmm. into culture and influence. And I was like, yeah, that's true. But it's hard. So it's like, yay, it's out there finally from A to Z, and yet it's only half. And yes, I still did get to teach. And so I feel really mixed on that. But there's no going back. I'm in. What do? You sort through the hate mail. And
yeah. I think one thing that really struck me that felt really relatable about the book is that someone that's experienced trauma or had a predator in their life, that I think you gave a really visceral description of how it feels to have that pull with them. This feeling of like, I belong to you. And one thing I studying in my issues of abuse class at my graduate school is that a predator or a perpetrator, they want to be omnipresent. They want to be omniscient in your life. So not just a trafficker, a pimp, or someone like this, a sexual abuser or something, they're basically saying, I'm God, I'm everywhere. And so mm-hmm. they're putting up those signs and those barriers that kind of like trap you into that box. And that's one thing I took away from your book. I read it and I thought, well, she gets it. Someone that maybe hasn't been trafficked even is going to read this and think, oh yeah, she understands my story.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't mm-hmm. know. That's something I took away. I don't know. Thoughts on that?
I love that. And I appreciate that. And I'm going to try to even use that on some things, because even now, you know, like I said earlier, the hate mail that I generally get or the rude comments I get are people just saying like, she's so stupid. She just didn't have morals. And I'm like, that is the exact response that I want to say, what you just said, which is, if you've never had a predator or a perpetrator that continually positions themselves to be omnipresent, then you won't get this. Mm-hmm. You will just continue to victim blame and call me stupid instead of really trying to understand how predators groom their victims in such a way that makes you feel like I'm never safe. Mm-hmm. I'm never, ever safe. They're always watching. They're listening to me right now. Mm-hmm. I have no way to get out. I don't know what to do. He's going to find me when I run. It's just this constant state of fear that I hope I tried to explain enough in the book, that I literally felt like my sanity was slipping away from me. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I couldn't, it's like holding onto an egg yolk, right? Like mm-hmm. I couldn't hold on to my sanity. I felt it. And I describe in the book where I start banging my head against the floor. Like I just felt like I was going crazy. And so then for people to come in and be like, oh, you were just stupid. You're like, you don't know actually how this feels mm-hmm. to have a predator be omnipresent mm-hmm. and your brain to respond where you start to feel yourself slipping away. Mm-hmm. That's a really scary place to be. And if you haven't been there, it's hard to judge, and maybe just try compassion instead, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that's where I came back to. I wanted to read you something that, actually my therapist said yesterday. I was talking and she was actually sharing a story and we were talking. And, so in the process of getting anybody that's been abused by a predator, there's this process of seduction. They want to seduce you. And that's their goal. They are seducing you. It's not just, that's what makes this complicated. It's this interplay between desire and delight in you combined with the harm that comes later. So here you have mm-hmm. this dynamic set up. And in order for me not to repeat this pattern later in my life, I have to actually look at that child and with no shame and no fight and no like violence towards myself say, yes, there's a reason I wanted to be seduced. I needed attachment. Mm. I needed connection. And that's not, the reason I wanted that isn't bad, but yes, that played into the hands of the abuser, right? And so I think when I hear haters like this, I want to respond and say, can you engage your own heart? Can you open yourself up and say, where was I harmed? And I actually can't bear my own face. And so I'm lashing out against Rebecca or Danielle or people that are actually naming this type of harm in their lives, because I actually think it's rooted in a lot of shame. That doesn't make you or me feel any better when people are like, you're stupid. I do think it's a way of saying like, actually, mm-hmm. where is your shame? Because I feel like something's going on there.
And I mean, Brene Brown is like one of my all-time favorites. Mm-hmm. I love all of her work. It's so great. And I think there is a risk that we take when we put our vulnerabilities out there. We admit our shame, we admit our guilt, and we just put it out there, and it makes people uncomfortable to sit in, and it makes people feel like they don't understand, and that's fine. I know that if 70% of the people that listen or read the book or hear an interview feel moved to compassion and feel like, wow, I'm going to think about this issue really differently now, and 30% don't, mm-hmm. and they're mean, and they're rude, and they're mm-hmm. judgmental. Mm-hmm. I've stepped out to say, that's okay, I'll take a 30% hit in order to make the 70 more aware. And it's scary, and it still hurts, and it doesn't mean it doesn't hurt my feelings, doesn't mean it doesn't hurt my parents' feelings, or my husband's feelings, or my children's feelings. Mm-hmm. And so all I can say is, like, they're just jerks, they're just bullies online, mm-hmm. you know, that want to make my mom feel bad about her parenting. Those are hard. And as a family, it's been hard to step out publicly and say, we'll take the 30% hit in hopes to change the 70. And that's not easy. Mm-hmm. What can you do? It's too late to go back now.
Yeah. I mean, I can't take the hit for you, but I definitely want to stand alongside you, you know?
Thank you.
I'm so grateful you have people in your life doing that too. It is mind-boggling that people act out in violence against a story, you know, like this. But I think it's that tension of they can't tolerate that kind of pain even, you know.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes with articles, it's hard. Interviews are great because you get to kind of control what you're going to say and how you're going to respond. But bigger articles are hard because you don't get to see the final edit. You don't know if they took notes well during your interview. You don't know if they twisted information. We had that happen with Sports Illustrated. We did an article in Sports Illustrated 2 years ago when my daughter was really thriving and tracking. She still is, but Sports Illustrated reached out. They wanted to do an article on her. Well, during the article, I talk about her dad and our relationship. And I even sent photos of her dad and her during her high school graduation. And Sports Illustrated article comes out and it cuts all of her dad out and says, Rebecca got pregnant by a summer fling. Oh. And it moves on. And his family flipped out on me and was like, How dare you say he was a fling? You guys were in love, da 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 da. And I'm like, I didn't say he was a fling. Mm-hmm. I actually went into great detail about him and I sent photos of him, but I don't get final say. And even when you demand fact check, really large publications like that will not allow it. They just won't. Mm. And I'm like, you tell an 18-year-old athlete that has Sports Illustrated knocking not to do an article, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Not to do an interview. And so it was hard and it sucked and I had to take that hit from them and I had to block a couple of them because they were being so rude about it. And it's just hard. It's like going public's hard. You don't always have control over edits. It is what it is. Like all you can trust is like, you know, again, the 70%, I just used it as an example. I don't obviously know exact statistics, but I just have to keep telling myself in my mind, like the 70% are being helped. This is the reason I'm doing this is to help people shape a culture. Mm-hmm. And that's all I can do. It sucks though.
Yeah. How are you caring for yourself in these spaces?
Man, again, I just don't know that I know that I'm nailing any of this well, but trying to be really present when it is a down day with my family. Today, as you can see, like I threw on a hat, no makeup, I'm in yoga pants. Like I'm just not exerting the energy on hair and makeup. I don't care. trying to allow that time to be, you know, be present with my kids. I played Legos last night. We built a really fun new dragon for the castle. Match your game, just playing games with my kids and trying to disconnect, turn my phone off at 5. I'm not responding to emails. I could check emails all night long. Mm-hmm. I can't. I have to turn. It's 5 o'clock. It's computers going off, phones going off. I'm being present because I have very few moments where I get to do that. And we just keep, reminding ourselves that the publicity from the book launch will die out. Mm-hmm. And, like it's a spike. And in the next couple months, things will slow back down back to a normal pace. And you just, you buckle up for the push and then you go back to normal. And I have people in my life that remind me of that. I have a great board. I've got a circle of friends and community that have been here before. Mm-hmm. That this is new for me, but that's not new to them. And so I get to rely on them a lot. And they'll say, hey, this will be a spike and then it'll go back to normal. And you'll be okay. You're going to get through this. It's going to be fine. And it's all good.
Whew, that is so much. And it's also like so many good things. I wonder how it'll feel when you get the rest time. I wonder if you'll be able to lean into that.
Yeah, I have some rest time blocked off on my calendar in April. So I'm excited for that. My daughter has a couple track meets that I've blocked off on my calendar that I get to go watch. And that's always really fun to not have the constant pull.
Yeah.
To be able to be there and to do things that I enjoy and to just have some quiet. I really want to start working on my next book soon. So yes. I need to try to get through this launch so I can block off some writing time for my next book. And yeah, it's fun. Going after the call of God takes work. It takes discipline. You're training like an athlete. But if you really want it and you want to do what God is calling you to do, then you have to do that. You have to, I want my daughter's, this has been so great having an athlete as a child because I get to watch her. Mm-hmm. She doesn't drink soda. She doesn't, right? She counts her water intake. She's being thoughtful around even during off season, but during season, like, things get strict and workouts are strict and her time in practice is strict. At Christmas break, she was home She worked out every single day. She woke up sometimes 6 a.m. and went to the track before, you know, even on Christmas, like off season, you still do something. And I love watching her because it's a great example for us in anything that we're passionate about. Are we going to be disciplined enough to put in the work that's going to get you to the call that you have on your life? Or do you want to go, I don't want to put in that much work and I'm okay here. And that's up to you. But God isn't forcing anything on us. We get to choose to engage as much as we want to engage. And, you know, we're human agents. We have free choice. Mm-hmm. We have free will. And he knows what's going to happen. He knows what we're going to do. but I think it's also up to us. Faith without works is dead. We have to put in the work if we really want it. And he's no respecter of persons. We all have a call. We all have something that he wants us to do. But it's how we're going to respond that I think really determines where we're going to go.
I believe that. Lately, someone said to me, and so you want to be a writer? They said this to me like 3 or 4 years ago, and they go, well, you need to write every day. And I took that really seriously. You need to put in the time. I was telling a friend recently, when you write, if you can't get anything down, write one word on a paper, save it, and then come back to it. See what happens that day. So it is just this idea that you need to practice in order to be good at something. You need to practice. You need to put in the time. You need to put in the effort. And you need to do it when no one else is looking or no one's paying attention. And I think that's the hard thing about culture. Like, you know, what do I have on Instagram or Facebook or whatever? But you don't see, like, for instance, you don't see your daughter up running, working out, or you don't see what you're doing in the quiet moments of your time. Or people are like, how do you do it, Danielle? Well, I get up at 5 and I write. You know, you have to take the steps every day that are going to get you somewhere. If that's what God is calling you to, especially, it's not like God just calls it and just like poof, like throws a book in your lap, you know?
Right. Totally.
Yeah. Like you said, like 2008, right?
Yeah. I mean, when I was in London, I started writing it and yeah, no one wanted it. They called it, there was a word they used for it, basically like dark. They were like, it's just too dark for, you know, I don't know. They called it some sort of genre that I was like, interesting. I would have never thought of it like that. But, yeah, it is interesting. It's hard. People don't know the time you put in, the work you do. They don't see it.
Yeah.
But it's so needed. Like you have to really go after it. Even you have to be, you know, even the Lord had called me to get more spiritually fit. Or I've heard speakers sometimes where they preach at a conference or at an event, and as soon as they start talking, it's like the anointing just hits you like a wave, and you're like, this person is anointed. And then I've heard speakers that are great speakers and they're gifted, right? And there's a difference. And I've cried out to God in my prayer time of like, God, I don't want to just be gifted. Like, I want to be anointed. Mm-hmm. And he said, you have to be dripping with my presence then. Mm-hmm. I have to spend more time with me. Mm-hmm. If you want to be dripping with my presence, that people feel that off of you. And I took that to heart, and I'm like, all right, I have to get into prayer daily. I have to be in his presence more. I have to say no to Instagram and yes to prayer. You have to mm-hmm. just like an athlete, you have to say no to fast food and yes to protein and veggie. Like you have to say no to going to that party and yes to waking up at 5 a.m. and working out. Like people get disciplined that if they really want to get good at their craft, and we're no different. You know, it's like, if you really want it, then you gotta do it.
Yeah. Well, we usually wrap up our podcast with three things. So I have three questions for you. Who are you listening to? Who's inspiring you? And what are you reading?
When you say listening to, like, podcast, music,
anything.
I love a good T.D. Jakes sermon.
Yeah.
I mean, if I want to get in the presence of God, I go to YouTube, put on T.D. Jakes, and it's like done. He's so good, man. What am I reading? I'm reading Mark Batterson's Chase the Lion or Lion in the Pit. I have both of them, and I'm kind of interchanging between those. I'm using that as my devotional time. I just finished Dale Mast's And David Perceived He Was King, and it was radically life-changing. I mean, unbelievably life-changing. What was the third one? So okay. T.D. Jakes, Mark Batterson,
who's inspiring
or Dale
you?
Mast. Who's inspiring me? excuse me. So many. It's hard to name something. Man, really. I mean, so many. My mom's inspiring me right now. My survivor brothers and sisters are so inspiring. I'm so grateful for the support and the just the response from the 70% that have been so kind. It's been so inspired. I feel really inspired by those who have been supporting me. So grateful that people would be that loud 70% to remind me to, you know, keep running the race. It's like you're right at the end of the marathon and you're exhausted and someone's right there and it's cheering you on. Like, mm-hmm. you can do it. You got mm-hmm. it. That's how I feel with everyone who's been so supportive. And so I'm just so inspired to finish strong. So just thank you. Thank you, everyone who's been that cheerleader. I wouldn't be able to keep going if it was only the loud 30%. So thank you. And thanks for sending in your comments and your emails and your messages. Keep them coming, man. I need them.
I love that. So if someone is listening to you, and one of the questions on the press release is, if a trafficked victim is watching right now, what would you say to her or him or them?
You know, I think that I would encourage people that you don't have to stay where you're at. It can feel, I love when you said, like a predator and their omnipresence. It can feel like there's no other options. And we just want to encourage you, like, there's hundreds of thousands of advocates and allies that are out here fighting for you right now. You can get out. You can start over. You can do it. I know it's scary. I know it's hard, but just jump for the stars. Like, just close your eyes and jump. There are so many people out here that want to help and will catch you. And will. When I found out about the human trafficking movement and I learned about people that had been fighting for me long before I was even trafficked, it was like, wait, what? There's this army of people who care about girls like me? Mm. I didn't even know. And that really shifted my heart to just not even realize that people cared. So I just want to encourage people that there are people out here that are ready to help fight for you and with you and advocate for you and help you navigate the unknown. And you can do this. I know it's scary. Just jump.
I love that. Thank you.